Think back to the last time you had a big test or exam to study for, whether it was years ago in high school or college or just last semester. How'd you get ready? Flashcards, practice tests, rereading your notes from class, maybe a little bit of everything. Our next guest says if we want to know what really works, we can look to psychology and how our brains actually retain information. He's looking mainly at school, but there are lessons here for learning at all levels, for work, fun, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you study during your time in school? Did you take thorough notes? What did that look like? Did you pull the infamous all-nighter to get ready for the big exam? What worked for you? What didn't seem to work? If you're a student right now, how do you study? Do you study? Teachers out there, how do you encourage your students to study and prepare? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Regan Gurung is professor of psychology and director of the general psychology program at Oregon State University. He's director there of the Center for Teaching and Learning, and he's co-author, along with John Dunlowski, of the new book, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. He's a former UW Green Bay professor. Regan, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be back, Rob.
Well, one thing that I learned from your book is I might have assumed that, you know, I'm either good at studying or I'm bad at studying, and there's not much I can do about it. The good news of your book, I think, is we can get better at it.
And that is, I think, a great place to start, because far too often, I think people have mindsets that go, I can do this, I can't do that. And I think most of us have probably heard now, whether it's math or something complex, instead of saying, I can't do that, or I'm not good at it, a good way to go is saying, I'm not good at it yet. And I think that's exactly what we set out to do in this book, is to say, look, even if you haven't had success before, here are some really clear-cut things you can do that can make you better at it. And it just takes some practice.
You start with some myth-busting and public myth number one, I think, the idea of learning styles. So we each have our own learning style, and we need to be taught and learn in a particular way. And this, a lot of people, I've thought this in my life. A lot of people that are listening right now, I'm sure, believe this. Regan, what does the research show?
So here's the big deal. I think I want to make clear the distinction between preferences and matching a teacher and students' learning styles. We all have preferences. We all have preferences for how we like to do things and learn things. But what the research looked at is it really important for the way a teacher teaches to match the preferred learning style of a student? And a very large study looked at all the research that was available and came to the conclusion that matching teaching style and learning style is not important. And in fact, we tend to learn better if we are exposed to different styles. So if you are somebody who goes, oh, I am a insert learning style here. Let's say I am a visual learner, but this person uses a non-visual style, therefore I can't learn. Well, nope, the research shows that's just not the case. So don't use that anymore. That learning style myth has been busted for some time now, but like you said, it's got some staying power. It's still out there. And every year I see the memes out there about learning styles. And I think we've got to remember, move on. You don't have to match learning styles.
That said, there are some things we need to understand about ourselves. And here's one that really hit me. You talk about the idea of a feeling of knowledge. And maybe at some point in everybody's school career, they had the thing like, hey, I got this. I'm ready to nail it. And then you don't nail it. You didn't know as much as you think you do. This is really important. How do we evaluate our feeling of knowledge of the upcoming test, say, versus where we really are?
Right. I think one big thing for us all to remember is that we are very good at deceiving ourselves. We are very good at deceiving ourselves, especially to make us feel better. And our cognitive processes aren't always a direct reflection of reality. So when we talk about the feeling of knowing or the feeling of knowledge, very often it really comes to play when we ask ourselves, do I know this or do I need to do more work on it? And very often we may think, we may be overly confident and think we know something when that's not really the case. And let me give you a really specific, I want to share something really specific where that really helps out here. Mm-hmm. This happens very often when we have what we are trying to study or what we want to know in front of us. So imagine studying with a textbook, or you know, if you are somebody using flashcards, remember you imagine having a whole bunch of flashcards in front of you. I don't know if you watched somebody use flashcards, Rob, recently, but if you take a look at somebody using flashcards, they will do the classic flip of the card, right? They look at the term on front of the card and then say, oh, do I know this? And then do a quick flip of the card to look at the answer and go, oh yeah, I know it. Well, that's exactly one of those very practical things you can avoid doing to make sure that your feeling of knowledge or feeling of knowing isn't skewed. Because if you have what you're trying to study in front of you, that artificially inflates your feeling of knowing. You think you know it more than you really do because you're not factoring in the fact that there it is, you can see it. And whether that's a flashcard that you've just flipped or your textbook sitting there, inflates the feeling of knowledge. You spend less time when you really should be spending more.
Talking to Regan Gurung about his new book. He's co-author, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If there's something that's worked for you studying at high school or college, or learning to pass a professional exam, something on the job, something that worked for you, something that didn't work for you, if you're doing it right now, maybe you need some advice. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Regan, you looked at research that's out there that compared a lot of different things that can be, many of which can be helpful. What stood out to you as the number one or two things that really pay off for study styles and methods?
Yeah, let's, jumping straight to the punchline, as it were. If you have time, your time studying is best spent testing yourself on the material. That's the number one finding across cognitive science, is that repeat testing or repeat practice, you testing yourself is one of the best ways that you can prepare yourself to learn. And this is in contrast to spending time rereading the material, even studying highlighted material or even flashcards. I mean, flashcards are useful. Studying key terms are useful, but not by themselves. The number one thing you can do is test yourself. The second best thing you can do, and I'll give you the top two, right? Because these are the two that are head and shoulders over everything else. Repeatedly testing yourself and spacing out your studying. And I think in the intro, you mentioned cramming. What cramming does is the complete opposite of spacing, right? Cramming is cramming it all into the night before the exam. The flip side, spacing it out, that's what's really good for you. And I love the way my co-author John likes to talk about it. He says, if repeatedly testing yourself and spacing it out were to date, they would lead to the really best way to do it, which is test yourself repeatedly, but spread out over time. And that's what's really going to get stuff from your working memory into your long-term memory, and you're going to be able to hang on to it much longer.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Cottage Grove. Rebecca, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share my experience of going back to college in my 40s. I didn't ever have a college degree. I dropped out of college when I was in my 20s, and I always regretted it. And I always thought, I can do that. I could do that. And I never went back. I finally went back for a healthcare degree, which is a pretty demanding field, and I really had to learn how to study. And I just wanted to share how I did it. I actually graduated 4.0 top of my class, and I got a 97 on my boards. And this is how I studied. So as an adult, you care more, right? Because you pay for your schooling out of your own pocket. So I wanted to study as much as I could, but I wanted it to be efficient. So I would tape all of my lectures on my phone and take notes in class, and then I would get home and I would rewrite my notes in outline form, and then I would listen to the lecture the next day on my way to school. And then in the end of the week on a Saturday, I would rewrite my notes again, but this time I would photocopy diagrams and color them in and label them. And then when I went to study, all my notes were perfection. So if I had to study, I had it all written two or three times already. And I kind of knew it all already, but I also made flashcards on my phone.
Wow.
Which now you can do in digital. So when I was sitting in waiting rooms, I would do flashcards. I was always quizzing myself. I would have people look at my flashcards and quiz me.
Nice.
I just did everything I could.
Rebecca, congratulations on going back, getting that degree, doing so well. I hear so much from your book there, Regan, spacing it out. She did that, you know, yep, over the course of time with the same material. Go where you want with it, because she gave us a lot to work with.
Oh, and you know, I mean, Rebecca, that's almost a case study in some of the best things to do. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of different things in there. The biggest thing I hope everybody listening saw or heard is Rebecca did a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. It's not just flashcards. It's not just one thing or the other. The real bottom line with studying is the more you do with the material, the better you're going to learn it. The deeper you process it, the better you're going to remember it. And I have to underline one big thing in what you said, Rebecca, because it's a whole chapter in the book, and that's note-taking. Note-taking is one of the most underutilized study techniques. It is an actual study technique. It's not just capturing information. And your example of writing and rewriting and playing with your notes, that's just such a neat thing to keep in mind, because when we take notes, we are processing the material more, and you doing that multiple times helped you process it more. And wow, yeah, no wonder there was a 97 there. So good job.
Rebecca, thanks again for calling. We're talking to Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story in your own life of effective studying or less effective studying, something that you thought might work but didn't, or you were pretty sure wasn't going to work and were proven right along the way, or if you're a teacher, if you teach people stuff, love to hear what you see in your students. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Regan Gurung, psychology professor at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. You can join in with your study habits, how they worked or let you down. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hello, everybody. I taught writing English for MPS for years. In fact, I founded the creative writing department at the High School of the Arts. I stayed in touch with many of my kids at the beginning, and the main reason they were able to succeed in college was that they were able to write. I spoke to the superintendent that making reading the top priority is wrong, because reading is passive. Writing is active. We work with journals. We wrote every day. In fact, when the head of the English department did
I think I got you, Bill. Got some background noise there. But Regan, the value, I mean, especially with a subject like English, the value of writing and journaling and just constantly doing it.
And I think that nicely underlines the note-taking point, because when you're writing, right, you're really having your brain do stuff with the material. And, you know, definitely in creative writing courses and in English courses, but I think writing in any format is getting you to do things with the material. That's why, you know, whether it's writing an essay or writing notes in class, instead of just writing down what's on a slide, you know, push yourself to write about what you're hearing, write about what you're reading. And even if you don't have a writing assignment in the class, you writing and pulling thoughts together and material together is having you do stuff with that material that, again, helps you hang on to it more and brings out more. You know, and that's why I think I have to throw in this, you know, in higher ed right now, there's all this, you know, a lot of us are concerned about ChatGPT and AI and writing. And it's almost like as good as ChatGPT is, the soul in the machine isn't there. And when we write, you know, there's stuff that's the emergent properties of our different thought processes are coming together in a way that where AI isn't there yet, you know, which is why any writing in class, any writing to process the material is going to help you learn better.
Bill, thanks a lot for calling in. Diane joins us now in Elkhorn. Diane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a daughter that was dyslexic. She was a very oral learner. And when she needed to learn something, I would sing it. I would put it in a song and she could learn it. I would sing her spelling words. I would sing her history facts. And now she works with a girl that has autism. And when she needs her to get dressed, she puts it in a song. And she has time to put on deodorant. And the girl sings, no stinky bits, no stinky bits. Anything I needed a child to do, if they wouldn't do it any other way, I would sing it. And oftentimes they would do it.
Diane, thanks a lot for the call. Whether it's singing or something else, Regan, I think creatively engaging with our material seems to be something that is going to help us.
Right, and beyond creatively engaging, what you see here is you're using more than one modality. So there's a more general term we call this dual coding. Whenever we're trying to remember something, if you can dual code it, where it's not just the word, but it's a word and music, or it's a word and a picture. To remember complex things, and in some cases, even things, you know, routines that you want to remember, if you can link something with either music or an imagery, it makes remembering certain things easier. And I think that's what we had here, was that it was almost a mnemonic device where that repetition yoked or tied to the melody helped, you know, recollection of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Regan Gurung, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. Back to your calls now. Maddie is on the line in Milwaukee. Maddie, hello.
Afternoon. How are you guys? Great topic.
Thanks. So what experience do you want to share with us, Maddie?
Well, back to Rebecca, and I'm assuming it was nursing school. I also went back to school after having other degrees in my 40s, and at MATC in Milwaukee, I found an amazing instructor. Unfortunately, she's passed away, but she taught a learning strategies course that really opened up my eyes and made me realize what my strong suits were and how to really hold on to what I was trying to learn. And in nursing school, there's a lot of heavy material.
I bet.
And this learning strategies between auditory, tactile, which writing your notes, auditory by recording the lectures and re-listening to them, and then verbally saying things out loud as well. So I love what Regan is teaching, and I think the professors and the teachers out there have seen students struggle, and they're finding ways to give a lending hand any possible way they can, because our future is about education and people having passion in their work. And when you're struggling with test anxiety and so forth, that's when you start having people drop out of school.
So. Maddie, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Regan, the idea of a class in how to learn, I'm assuming you're on board with this idea.
Oh, absolutely. I actually teach a course in the science of teaching and learning where we go into it. And, you know, honestly, it's not even just the class. I think far too often, many of us, especially in college and universities, assume that our students know how to do this. And it's not that easy. There is science that shows you the right ways, but it's not necessarily what you would normally think of as being the right ways. And I think, you know, I'm a big proponent of it, no matter what class you're teaching, especially if it's a first year class or a second year class, take time out of class to talk about study strategies, to talk about the best way to go. Because both Maddie and Rebecca alluded to, you know, many medical terms and a lot of terms to memorize. That can be stressful, but the good news is a lot of these strategies, retrieval practice and note-taking and spacing, those are exceedingly good, especially if you have medical terms or a lot of content to memorize. So right on board with that, we need to be talking about this more and not assuming that people know how to do it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Maddie. Regan, I want to talk about big picture strategy. In one of your chapters, you talk about scheduling, having our plan of how and when we're going to fit these different study methods into our actual lives. Can you tell us, give us an overview of that?
Sure. I think one of the thinking about thinking and planning all falls into the jargony term metacognition. But metacognition, or really planning out your studying, is really the first critical step to establishing a good study pattern. And I think this becomes even more important when you factor in that a person may have 2, 3, 4, 5 classes and work and all of these different things to do. So when you plan out or schedule out when you're going to study, that makes it more likely that it gets done, because then you can visually note what all you have to get done and where. It's also important to actually walk the walk of some of these key practices. I mean, I may say repeatedly testing yourself is good, and I will say spacing it out is good, but it's very hard to remember to space things out and remember to repeatedly test yourself when you've got 5 classes and work. So starting with scheduling, and you find the way you want to do it. I'm old school. I love paper. You can use, you know, an app, but have a schedule of when you're going to do what, and that right there takes out some cognitive load, mental load, and it makes it easier to focus on what you have to do and when.
Regan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the book Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. If you have a lesson learned you'd like to share, you can still do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.